as a continuation, really, of the thread of the dialogue that was started earlier today, if you had a chance to attend the morning session. There is much debate about the appropriate policy tools to address climate change. If you think that climate change is an issue that needs to be addressed, your attention soon turns to, well, what would be the appropriate instruments by which we could solve the climate change problem? And there are a number of candidates, taxes, subsidies, cap and trade, technology-based limitations on certain sectors, efficiency standards, and so forth. These debates typically go on as if all the world were the same in terms of basic institutions, that all the world has basically the same sorts of economic systems, legal systems, and cultural frameworks within which these instruments could be applied uniformly. And, of course, if you think about it, that's not true at all. And Ruth Greenspan Bell, who's going to be our speaker, is really first and foremost in the world, as far as I know, in pointing this out and developing the implications of this basic truth, this basic cultural diversity for environmental programs generally and for global climate change in particular. She has explored cultural diversity and its implications for environmental programs in such places as Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Russia, Thailand, China. And, of course, from her earlier experience with the United States EPA, she is deeply familiar with the culture of the United States as it affects or may affect environmental programs. So her inquiry has been the effect of this cultural variability and its implications for programs like climate change. And she's here today to share her unique insights and provide some recommendations, I think, or at least some suggestions for how we might deal with global cultural diversity in the context of addressing a global environmental problem like climate change. Ruth is currently a resident scholar at Resources for the Future, and she is director of Resources for the Future's Program for International Institutional Development and Environmental Assistance. Before that, she was senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and the Environment. And before that, it seems lives ago now for both of us, she was at in the General Counsel's office at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency during a period when I also was in that office for at least a brief time, and that's where our paths first crossed. Certainly an auspicious connection for me, and I'm glad to see it continue to bear fruit in her appearance today. So it is my great pleasure to introduce to you my friend and distinguished scholar, Ruth Greenspan Bell.
Thank you so much for inviting me here today. It's a real pleasure, and I gained a lot from the morning's discussion. I think, you know, this sort of issue about how do you struggle with people's daily habits, you know, things that they don't even think about on a daily basis, is a really critical issue as we start thinking about how you change the overall pattern of greenhouse gas emissions. I'm particularly pleased to be here because, and John did not pay me to say this, John Cannon was the best general counsel we ever had at EPA, just bar none, and it was a total pleasure to work with him. I learned a lot, and I think everybody in the office did. It was, you guys are very, very lucky to have him here at UVA. After My talk is called No Neat Answers to Messy Problems. And that's the problem with life, you know, when you have a problem like carbon, which has been so much a part of every piece of our lives for many, many years, and now you're trying to address it, well, there are you know, somebody said there are no silver bullets. Somebody else told me the other day the notion of silver buckshot. Maybe we can hope for silver buckshot. After November, climate change and doing something about it has abruptly come on the U.S. national scene. And it's pretty clear that every serious candidate for president, Republican and Democrat, is committed to doing something about it. I was totally amazed to be watching, I think it was CNN, and see the chairman of the Republican National Committee in an interview in a hallway list climate change as the second issue. You know, there's Iraq and actually he was trying to avoid Iraq, but he listed climate as a second issue, and I think that's a huge advance here. So there's, things have stagnated, but now I think there's some room for a little bit of hope and some momentum. And part of that is, as John has indicated, is my thought that this opens the door, I think, for some rethinking of how to engage in the international community in the overall effort. Once the United States actually does something, we're in a position to actually go out there and start talking to the rest of the world. We haven't been for a long time, but I think some doors can open up. I want to talk a little bit about my own take about how we go about doing something about greenhouse gas emissions, starting with concerns I have with the Kyoto Protocol. And then I want to think ahead about alternative routes forward. The worldwide system of emissions trading that's embodied in Kyoto is very similar to systems that were promoted country by country in most of the former Soviet bloc and in China. And it's something I know a lot about because I was part of efforts to try to make those things happen. Sometimes I was part of teams promoting emissions trading to manage SO2 and other pollution challenges. And the basic problem is that emissions trading in these countries has never worked for some very fundamental reasons that John foreshadowed in his introduction. The idea, as everybody knows, was that firms that could control their pollution more cheaply could accumulate credits and sell them to others who might otherwise spend more to reduce their pollution. But here was the basic problem. In Russia, Ukraine, Poland, no one was controlling their pollution, and no one had the incentive to do so. There was no regulatory system that really forced them to do that. There were laws on the books, but they had little to do with actual practice. There was no culture of compliance, which I think is a really important. People say, well, you need enforcement, but what you really need is a culture of compliance, and then you use enforcement for those guys who decide to thumb their nose at you and hope that there are a limited number of people. Laws were generally something that were enforced when it suited the needs of the leaders and not otherwise, and we've had some kind of Orwellian examples of that recently, where Vladimir Putin suddenly remembered he had environmental laws when he was in disputes with foreign oil companies. So, you know, law can mean something quite different from what American lawyers are trained to think that it is. Most Soviet bloc countries had a system of fees and fines for failure to meet environmental requirements, but they were funded through standard budgets to the enterprises, the so-called soft budgets. And these countries have been cut off for years from real markets. Somebody in a ministry dictated what a particular factory would make and how much of it. Energy was provided pretty much for free, and so were raw materials. And none of these countries had the institutions to make sure that markets would work. No independent courts, no oversight systems, nothing approximating transparency. And all of what I've said here is especially true with respect to environmental standards. They didn't work very well, and there really wasn't any good experience with environmental protection. In the early 1990s, a few countries were just starting to disentangle all this. Nevertheless, advisors came in from the West and said that firm environmental requirements and making enterprises actually meet those standards was a throwback to the socialist system. And I think they loaded the dice by using terms that have almost become ubiquitous now, like command and control. But I don't think command and control is a very fair term to use when you're talking to somebody who literally came out of a genuine command and control system, because this seemed to suggest a throwback to the Soviet system, and it obscured an idea that I think should have been openly debated. And their advice was you should be harnessing the market. The advocates either forgot or they didn't care to understand that what motivated U.S. firms to want trading or what made it work. So I sat in meetings in Central Eastern Europe in which outside advisors and internal experts were literally like, you know, ships passing in the night. Now let's fast forward from the early 1990s in Central Eastern Europe to China in about 1998-99. And again, outside experts, we all know because it's almost daily in the newspapers now of the tremendous environmental challenges in China. And outside experts came in and they determined that China could fix its SO2 problem by harnessing markets. Now, I appreciate that these suggestions come out of huge frustration with Chinese pollution, but I think it was wrong-headed from the start. The question is, why would a highly polluting Chinese coking operation, for example, or power plant want to do this? The bottom line was and is that enterprises were doing nothing to control their pollution. So why would they feel the need to save money on environmental regulation when they weren't spending any to begin with? And we had there's a sort of a deep system of corruption anyway in terms of how environmental standards are managed. Local environmental enforcers basically would tell you when you got to know them a little bit and you were kind of talking offline a little bit that they were faking results, that they knew very well, you know, what obligations they had out of their 5-year plans. And they knew what their bosses wanted, and so they provided the numbers and the answers their bosses wanted. The industries were actually under the control of local and provincial officials, and their actual incentives were to provide full employment, make sure there was full employment, and make money for the local provincial government. And, you know, a lot of these industries operated under the equivalent of either soft budgets or loans from banks that were controlled by the same provincial and local authorities. No independent environmental authority, no independent judges. We know something about that these days. In China, they're just struggling with these ideas and struggling with trying to make these work. And there was little or no experience with the highly sophisticated markets in which people buy and sell intangibles. I mean, this is not a widget. This is not a marketplace where you can walk in and look at the good that somebody's selling you and decide whether it's, you know, what you want, whether it has defects, et cetera. We're talking about a highly intangible kind of commodity here. So, in the end, it shouldn't be a surprise that none of these ideas and programs really worked. In Shaanxi province, where I worked, after a lot of fuss, there was one mandated trade. Enterprise X was basically told to trade with Enterprise Y and told how much, and that fulfilled the kind of obligations everybody had to make, you know, to make it look like all this effort had been worth the time. So none of this real-world experience would seem to recommend using a worldwide emissions trading system for CO2, but that is exactly what has happened. Kyoto is grounded in the assumption that the opportunity to profit from greenhouse gas emissions will motivate generators of CO2 wherever they are located to make the necessary changes in how they operate their power plants, their factories, and their vehicles. And it sets up the famous, you know, flexible mechanisms, which we all know about, the clean development mechanism, which facilitates trading with the developing world, and joint implementation. And now there are several other trading systems in Europe and elsewhere. The difficulty is that the idea comes from economic theory and the U.S. cap and trade system to control acid rain, which I believe is a very successful program, but you have to think about why that program worked in the United States. So, from my point of view, it's kind of a small amount of empirical evidence from U.S. practice, but it's really, you know, everybody's caught the fever. And that is the problem from my point of view. Whether trading is realistic or it's a utopian notion, when directed against such a huge global challenge is anyone's guess, because really there isn't much evidence. In the face of a physical threat that is that nobody fully understands its twists and turns and unpredictability, we are flying blind, I believe, on the solutions end of the equation. And it's really important from my point of view, when you think about how this is going to work globally or how it does work, to really think hard about the U.S. program, the SO2 trading program. The U.S. program is really a technique to increase the economic efficiency of a classic command and control regulatory program. There is someone who is establishing a cap and then pushing it down. It has to go down. And trading works, but not entirely just because of the magic power of markets. The SO2 market isn't remotely laissez-faire. Regulators obviously demand these decreases over time. There are automatic and very tough penalties against violators. Trading transactions are regulated down to small details. Polluted air is the commodity, so traders use mandated and rather elaborate accounting measures. And the whole system is works in pretty close to complete transparency. I mean, everybody knows that every credit or allowance has a serial number. So we know that nothing approximating the rigor of this can actually happen globally. It's just not possible. The question is, does it need to be that rigorous? Well, who knows? You know, what it needs to have is sufficient integrity that we know the program is reducing greenhouse gas emissions, not just making some people rich. And how do we make sure of this result? Well, there aren't very good mechanisms in the international arena for this. We know that we're not going to let other countries come in and police our internal efforts, and no other country will do that either. So we have to come up with something else. So far, the only plan for Kyoto noncompliance is rooted in the assumption that countries would not risk being shut out of participation in the flexible mechanisms. We don't know yet whether that's strong enough. So we have activities taking place right now, the CDM activities and these projects that are being put together. And CDM has a seemingly rigorous regime for approving projects, and that should be foolproof, right? Well, there's some studies now that are really raising fundamental questions about that. India's Center for Science and Environment recently examined a couple of projects to provide credits, and they concluded that it is impossible to determine whether the transactions actually meet the standards. They complained about lack of transparency. They were concerned that the projects may have been approved by Indian authorities on the basis of the prestige of the consultant that validated them, rather than the project's merits, and they were concerned that important conditions of the transactions were yet to be met, despite being specified in the project design document. I'm not trying to paint all projects with this problem, but I am saying that the issue is the issue in the end comes down to the integrity of the local efforts to reduce emissions. That's what has to be key here. And what about the argument that the desire to make money can provide the right incentives to control greenhouse gas emissions? Probably most of you saw the front page headline story in the New York Times on December 21st, 2006. It was very unusual to have in the front page of the New York Times on the right-hand side an article about the CDM, basically. And basically what it says was that, yes, profits motivate people to get into the emissions trading business, but venture capital investment firms often want quick, high, immediate profits, and now we're hearing that hedge funds are getting engaged in these deals. As a result, it's possible that something is getting lost, and that something is the focus on emissions reductions. In the examples, the example the Times used, which was based on a study by somebody at Stanford, and I can, if you want to get hold of that, I can make it easy for you to do that. Money found its way to a few particularly lucrative cleanup deals. In China, this investment incinerated a waste gas. The investors put in about $500 million because it's less expensive than cleaning up their own operations. They paid a premium far beyond the actual cost of the cleanup, in this case about 100 times the actual cost of the incinerator in question. And here things get completely pretty perverse. The proceeds go to the owners of the Chinese factory, a Chinese government energy fund, and the consultants and the bankers who put together the deal. The profits to the Chinese help them expand existing factories that make the old refrigerant and to build new factories to sell air conditioning units into a growing Chinese market. Now, I'm told that there's some talk now about clamping down on this particular emission as a vehicle for CDM credits. But I think we still have a situation where the Chinese investors, flush with money, proceeded to use it the best way they could, which is rational from their point of view, but not terribly good for the environment in general. So the lure of quick profit encouraged short-term fixes, I think, at the expense of fundamental long-run solutions, including developing renewable energy sources like solar or wind. And as word of deals like this has spread, everybody involved in this nascent business is searching for other big jackpots like this. And what about investing in more modest deals, like small wind farms? This is how the chief operating officer of Eco Securities was quoted in the New York Times. This is an emissions trading company. He said, "If you don't have a humongous margin, it's not worth it." I want to be real clear. This is not to say that the market cannot play a role in the right circumstances. But I think the problem, and we've put all of our eggs in this basket, and I'm not sure that's a good idea given the magnitude of the threat that we're facing. So what should we be doing forward? Well, wish I had a great answer to that. My own feeling is that we have to do this the old-fashioned way. There's no miracle cures. I think environmental regulation must become a priority in the developing world, and there's lots of things that could be done to help that happen. The environment ministry is never a power ministry in most countries around the world. It's usually a place to park partners from, coalition governments or small political parties or make a political statement. So give these guys some power. Let them sit at the grown-ups table and do what their job is supposed to do. But on the other hand, I think environment ministers also have to, for their part, overcome the perception that environmental controls are a luxury item. This is an attitude in a lot of countries. A smart environmental minister can show that controlling waste can increase wealth. And, there are a lot of wonderful examples about these days. And the best one to me is Walmart, which has made a major commitment to wring waste out of their systems, and they're making money doing it. I think lessons like this can be used at least to get a head start, to get things moving in countries where we're not seeing much progress on this subject. You would think that markets make firms do these things automatically. So why haven't these enterprises, for that matter U.S. firms, been doing this anyway? But they don't. They don't automatically. There's lots of incentives that cut various ways in how operations make their decisions. And you can see that if you visit operations in China, for example, where pollution is literally leaking out of every seam and pipe in the system. This represents wasted resources, and someone is paying for it, but it's hard to trace that back and make the connection. Greater efficiency won't solve the problem, but it would certainly be a good start in places where they're just simply really inefficient. Environmental enforcers need some sort of level of independence to do their job. They need skills to monitor and inspect. This message is starting to be understood various places. There's now an interesting network developed in Asia of environmental enforcers, and hopefully this will start the ball rolling. I think, as John alluded in the introduction, I think we also have to think harder and in less stylized ways about what really motivates people in each of the countries that need to control emissions. I think I've expressed concern about whether the profit motive drives people, But I think, frankly, law advisors have often been as culpable, my own profession, as have been economists, for example, in assuming that just writing a law in, for example, China will have the same impact in the, as in the United States. This is not a law-based society. It has no familiarity or history of using laws in those ways. So something beyond just writing laws is going to have to be the way to go forward. I think we need to identify and use levers that work within the local traditions and cultures, find things that are salient within each, within these key countries, India and China, to see whether we can't bring them into the, into this fight in a more constructive way and make it kind of worth their while in some way or some way resonant with the values that they care about a lot. You know, we all know there are lots of ways to enlist people to, into this effort. There was some mention this morning about citizens and individuals getting involved. Improvements in air quality in Delhi, India were significant improvements, moving commercial vehicles, from highly polluting, petrol and adulterated, diesel and petrol to CNG was the result of a lawsuit brought by an NGO in the Indian Supreme Court, and the case was prompted along by another NGO. I think there's lots of, you know, examples where citizens can be brought in to push this process along in the right circumstances. It's probably going to work in India. It's probably not going to work so much in China where there are no real NGOs. I think we should be... One thing we might think about, and this is really sort of early in my thinking about this, is we should be possibly rethinking how the international negotiations are handled. The process of having all the countries at the negotiation table is time-consuming and cumbersome, and at this point the emissions, I think, of only a handful of countries really count. If we can get some control on that, we would be, you know, we could make it some better progress forward. All countries need to be part of the process, but it's also possible to think about several tracks rather than just one in international negotiations. All of those countries are going to have to be at the table because adaptation is going to be a huge problem for many of those countries. But what we really need is, you know, us and Europe and India and China and Brazil and maybe Korea and a handful of countries at the table to really get a handle on this. And I think that the possibility for that opens up once the United States does something serious, because then we can start convening and these kinds of discussions and moving things forward. And then finally, I'd like to make a plea that we get over this whole obsession with cost. It's only money, and we're still a wealthy nation. When it matters, somehow or other, we find the money. If you do a little simple calculation of the latest emissions inventory and the conservative annual cost of the Iraq war, it's the equivalent of a $60 a ton carbon tax. The most aggressive carbon tax I've heard anybody talk about so far is like $25 or something like that. When it matters, we find the money. Americans, Joe Rahm likes to say, spend $22 billion last year for luxury bathrooms. And unlike building Humvees, which are just being built to be exploded in Baghdad streets, investments in climate are really an investment in a new economy and a new way of going forward. So it's a productive investment. It's not just a cost. We have to talk about it as an investment. And then we've got to think about whether we're going to be willing, as a people, to pay the incremental cost to be sure that a coal plant built in China is an IGCC plant. They're going to build those coal plants. So what's our responsibility? Is it just to wring our hands and sit on the sidelines? Well, maybe we should be considering kind of the equivalent of a Marshall Plan to try to get a handle on some of these issues. The real question we need to face is whether we can afford not to do this. Thank you very much.